News are supported by our lovely members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's hot out. You know it. I know it. As much as it's been recognized that the human-caused climate crisis is contributing to higher temperatures and heat waves, our built environment can do the same, especially in cities. It's called the urban heat island effect, which basically means that cities experience much warmer temperatures than nearby rural areas do. But just how much of an impact does this effect have, and how is it connected to the environment in different neighborhoods? Climate Central looked at this question in new research released on July 10th. Across the country, they looked at 65 major cities and estimated how much hotter it gets than baseline in different neighborhoods because of what residents have built there. Of the 50 million people included in the analysis, 68% lived in an area with an urban heat island index of 8 degrees or more. So when the forecast says it's going to be 80 degrees, people experience a temperature of 88 degrees in those neighborhoods. In Portland specifically, 60,000 people live in parts of the city that have a UHI index of 9 degrees or more. But what exactly are the factors that make different neighborhoods hotter? The first one is called albedo. Here's the MIT Concrete Sustainability Hub to explain.
If you've ever walked barefoot on pavement in the summer sun, you probably know how burning hot it can get. This phenomenon, as it turns out, is more than just a nuisance. It actually has a dramatic impact on our daily lives, from the Earth's climate to human health. We refer to it as albedo. Here's how it works. Solar radiation constantly enters the atmosphere, where it is either absorbed or reflected by the Earth's surface. While the energy that is absorbed stays and warms the Earth, the reflected energy travels back to the atmosphere, some of which is returned to space. Albedo is a measure of this reflected radiation. The higher the albedo, the more energy is reflected, and the lower the albedo, the more energy is absorbed. We can actually measure the magnitude of albedo, in large part due to color. Lighter colored surfaces reflect more radiation, which we perceive as light, and have a higher albedo. On the other hand, darker surfaces absorb more light and have a lower albedo. So what impact does albedo have on our lives? When sunlight hits a city, dark, man-made surfaces on pavements and roofs absorb this energy and begin to heat up. This warms surrounding areas throughout the day and long after the sun sets.
There are two other factors that influenced the urban heat island index too, along with albedo. The percentage of green space makes a difference. Plants help cool the air through a process called evapotranspiration, and less vegetation means less cooling. If you've spent any hot summer days in the forest, you may have felt the difference. Plants can help reduce peak summer temperatures in cities between 2 and 9 degrees, one study found. The other big factor is population density. Lots of human activities create extra heat. Think transportation, industrial facilities, and cooling down buildings. So sun-absorbing surfaces like roads, less green space, and high population density contribute to higher temperatures in urban areas. It's worth noting that extreme heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard in the U.S., so tackling urban heat islands could really make a difference as our weather gets more extreme because of the climate crisis. To learn more about this research, I spoke with Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central. Thank you for being here. So we're talking about your new analysis of urban heat islands. Talk me through this sort of the basic top line stuff here. What was it that you sought to measure in this work?
All right. Well, we focus on climate change. And a lot of times climate change is confused with urban heat islands, and they're separate. And so we wanted to really kind of distinguish between the two. The fact that there's baseline temperatures going up everywhere, whether you're in a city or not in a city. But in the city, there's an additional risk because temperatures are warmer in the city, basically because of two really broad things, which are the built environment, buildings, streets, and population density. So all the heat we produce living every day. And so we wanted to put some measures on that so people could see what the, you know, the estimated additional risk was for people in different cities, and maybe provide a guide for folks to know what neighborhoods and what areas of the city might be most at risk.
Talk me through a little bit of the methodology. How did you go about measuring this kind of thing?
Yeah, ours is a little different. So a lot of people would have measured urban heat island, which is good because I think they all work together to kind of give us a more complete picture. Our method was a broader method, and we used a model value. And basically, the model builds in the types of design in the city. Is it dense building structure? Is it skyscrapers? Is it parkland? And then it also builds in population density. And based on those values, researchers have estimated how much additional heat that will provide to an area. And so we were able to, there's been some great research done really plotting the whole country, the land cover of the whole country. And we were able to look at all these different cities and outside of cities as well and say, this is the land cover. And based on that, this is how much additional heat there will be in this area.
So, right, your analysis looked at 65 different U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the trends that you noticed around the country?
Well, the kind of the baseline temperature we found that really existed in all the cities was 8 degrees. So that's really where all the cities had at least some measurable part of their population that was living at an area that was 8 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise if it was not for the built environment around them. And so that was kind of the big one. Some people, you know, some cities, the temperatures would go up to 10, 12 degrees, maybe even higher. But really, that 8-9 degree spot was really the sweet spot across the West. And that's a lot of heat, really, because if you're talking about 80-degree temperatures, that could mean your day feels it's 89, 90 degrees. So that, I think, would be the main finding. And knowing that more and more people live in urban environments now, there's more and more people who are going to be at risk.
Well, and you also looked at Portland, Oregon, where I am speaking to you from.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you notice about the maps of Portland?
Well, Portland is, there seems to be two ways that cities have their heat distributed. They have either a kind of an urban core, and the heat is really focused in the urban core. You'll see that maybe in like Chicago, I think, is a good example of that. You'll see kind of this spot in the middle, and that's where the heat is. Cleveland has that too. And then other cities tend to be more West Coast cities, Southwest cities, and some cities in Florida. The heat is more dispersed, which seems to represent a different growth pattern in those cities, and that maybe there isn't just this one urban core where everyone lives, but there's different densities around the city, different growth patterns around the city. And that's what we saw more for Portland, was some hot spots kind of scattered around the Portland area.
Obviously, urban heat islands are a big issue, and you know, we're talking now at the end of Portland's first big heat wave of the summer, where at least 6 people have died in connection to the heat wave, many of them actually in southeast Portland. What does your research indicate to policymakers? Is that part of the conversation as well, as how to act on this kind of information?
Well, our goal is to really get the information out to the communicators of the world to help tell the story of where this is happening and how this is happening. And then hopefully the policymakers or even community organizations or citizens will pick it up and say, okay, what can we do about this now that we've realized it's not just our imagination. There's a real problem here, and there's a real issue that's making us feel hotter. I think it's easy for sometimes you say, oh, I'm just, you know, I just think I'm feeling hotter. But in these places, it truly is. And so hopefully then solutions can be targeted in a way to maybe the places that need it the most right now, and then rolled out more gradually into places that are maybe in a little better shape at this time.
You mentioned some of the things that you measured that are known to contribute to a higher urban heat island in this index. having to do with the built environment, how much paving there is. What are some of the things that are maybe the opposite of that, that cut down on this extra heat spike?
Yeah, there's actually, this is one interesting thing about this topic, is there are solutions, and there's solutions at different scales. Say a neighborhood said, we have to take action, and we want to take action right now, and we can't wait for our city to take action. They might decide to put up something as simple as umbrellas along the street or some sort of awnings along the street to cool the street where their residents are walking or sitting or standing at the bus stop, or trees. Everyone, trees is always a favorite, but trees sometimes take longer to grow, so that's kind of one of the problems with trees. You don't always get the shade immediately, but maybe you decide to plant some trees. Maybe you decide there's a big swath of pavement. Maybe it's something that was abandoned, and it would be cooler if you made that into a community garden, say. And these things, like I said, they could be in very small size, or they could be in a bigger size, where a whole city makes an effort to identify these kind of neighborhoods and spots and make these bigger changes. And then there's engineering changes, which there seems to be a lot of experimentation with now. You may have heard about their pavement lighter colors, so it's more reflective in some cities. White roofs have been popular for a while to reflect, or green roofs, so you also reduce the amount of heat that absorbs. So those are obviously bigger engineering solutions that are probably going to need to be done by cities or building owners. But there's a whole range, which is a really nice thing about this problem being able to be solved.
I think that it is at a stage, especially for Portland right now, where, you know, we can look to other cities who have much more of a history with intense heat. We're not really used to it here. And, you know, our built environment doesn't reflect kind of the needs of how extremely hot it's been getting.
Right. And so many of them have traditionally been built to keep us warmer. And it's just a design choice. When you're thinking, oh, what do we need from this building? We need this building to keep us warm. And now more and more months of the year, we really need to keep cool. Another advantage that places like Portland and Seattle have, that where the heat is really emerging, and if some of the systems are going into places, they can do it the right way and the best way. You know, sometimes you walk through older cities on the East Coast, there's a lot of window units that spew a lot of heat out the back of them. You know, maybe when buildings go up, or when air conditioning now is installed in buildings in the Northwest where it wasn't before, it can be done in a more efficient way, a cleaner way, a way that's not going to distribute waste heat, but a way that's also going to use the grid more efficiently and use less carbon, which is just adds to the vicious cycle of this. So there's an opportunity there for your area to kind of build into a hot zone in a better way.
Another thing that's mentioned in your research is how this urban heat is unequally distributed and how that lines up in some ways with the history of racial redlining. Can you touch on that issue a little bit?
I won't go too in depth because that was conducted by our friends at Columbia University, and they were kind enough to let us kind of have that study with ours so we could give people that additional resource. And what they looked at was cities all around the country and looked at where were the historically redlined districts. And they found in those areas that temperatures tended to be hotter than in the areas that were not historically redlined. And, you know, it varies from city to city, but it was a pattern overall across the country. So, again, that may help people if they want to go in. And like you said, you know, Portland is kind of at the beginning of this thought about, you know, what are we going to do when it gets really hot? Maybe that'll help you say, these are the neighborhoods that are probably most at risk, and we should target them in our efforts.
You've touched on this a little bit, but how do you feel that your analysis with Climate Central fits into other urban heat island research? Where is it in that conversation?
Yeah, ours is kind of a broader scope. A lot of people, what they'll do is they'll go out on like a few days of the year and take temperatures. So that's very helpful to give you kind of an actual temperature on this block or this neighborhood. Because other people have looked at heat in particular neighborhoods that maybe are lower income or traditionally with discriminated populations. So I'm hoping that ours is just kind of another piece. We're able to take a broader look too, because you don't need as many resources to go into 65 cities if you are doing a more modeled approach. So we're hoping also we can maybe provide some cities that don't have the resources to do the really in-depth analysis, some starting points to think about. So hopefully it kind of is part of the bigger picture. And with all these things, we're going to start to really be able to focus in on what the problem is.
And off of your analysis, are there more questions to be answered? Like where might research go after this?
Oh, I think, yeah, there's definitely always more questions to be answered. Probably the big one is to continue to look at the demographics and how different populations are affected, whether that be age or race. So that's another one that always needs more analysis. And then I think we need to start looking at how the solutions are working, because people are putting solutions into place. So it'll be interesting to see if people can start measuring, you know, this neighborhood maybe we looked at 10 years ago, didn't have any parks, didn't have any green space. Now it does. How much cooler is it in that neighborhood? Really like to see the success of some of those solutions being documented.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't touch on?
I guess the only thing just to say is that because the built environment is and population is the culprit, you can also find some hotspots outside of cities. They aren't as intense, but wherever you have intense development without cooling factors like trees or parks, you're going to have hotter spots. And so I think, you know, that's the other thing that we kind of liked about this is we're able to kind of show that there's hot spots outside of cities too, and we need to be conscious of that the built environment can get you anywhere.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you, and good luck in the heat.
That was Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central, speaking with me about a new study out July 10th on urban heat islands. Their analysis showed that nearly 34 million U.S. residents in the nation's biggest cities live in a neighborhood where the built environment around them makes it feel 8 or more degrees hotter. More information on their research is online at climatecentral.org. Check out a map of Portland's Urban Heat Island Index on our website, kbu.fm. For KBU News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kanani Cortez, the digital producer at Street Roots. We're talking about her newest article for the paper. It's called Oregon Prison Celebrates Its First Pride Event. A small group organized a historic event to bring visibility to prison's LGBTQIA2S+ communities. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So your latest article talks about the first ever Pride event that was held at the Oregon State Correctional Institution that happened on June 14th. Tell me about this event. How was it put together?
Yeah, so like you said, this is a really special event as it's the first official Pride celebration of a gun in an Oregon prison. And so there were kind of four people at the helm of organizing this, plus a bunch of other volunteers and supportive folks. But that's Christine Shope, who is a staff member. She's part of the Behavioral Health Services Department at OSCI. Along with Jacob Barrett, Tyler Young, and Brian Killian, who are three folks that are currently incarcerated at OSCI. And so they kind of had this collective effort with other folks after hearing about, you know, this need for more support and visibility for LGBTQ+ members in the prison. And they've been involved with maybe other groups, their recovery support groups, and there's like the Many Nations Club. And Christine Shope had mentioned a really successful mental health and suicide awareness kind of event and conversation that had occurred in years past, and that really kind of inspired this idea that she had that, you know, talking about taboo topics and issues in the prison can help change the culture around certain topics, and in the way that mental health and suicide is not discussed, but it is a huge issue in the facility. She really saw that the same could be done for better supporting LGBTQ members in the community. And so what the event looked like was they invited several outside organizations who do services specific to either recovery or LGBTQ plus recovery, some of those being True Colors recovery and Straight Roots as well. And so there was an opportunity for those organizations to kind of table and hand out flyers, materials about resources that they offer and just kind of build relationships with people in the community there. And there was also several speeches done by some of the organizers and members of the LGBTQ community in the prison. And so it was a great event. There was music. It was all in the recreation yard. And they had also facilitated some really wonderful decorations. And there was music. And so I think it was really a unusual occurrence compared to kind of an everyday in the rec yard at OACI.
What was the response like to this event?
It was a really huge turnout. The organizers said, you know, they didn't really know what to expect, but there were over 400 people who came out to the rec yard that day for the event from the facility. And so it was a really huge turnout. And I think really they said that they're already hearing really positive feedback and felt like they engaged folks who they wouldn't usually expect to come out for an event like this. And yeah, it seems like folks were having fun. And I think that, you know, Pride celebrations now and outside of an institution like this, they look really different. And I think there's a lot of expectations for what Pride looks like. And a lot of it is really, you know, leads into kind of this consumerism. And there's a lot of, I think, really valid criticisms of Pride's kind of corporate existence as it is now. And so I think that this was a really beautiful contrast to that, where it was an opportunity for people to just be in community with each other, learn about each other, chat, spend some time outside. But also knowing that it is a really incredible thing to celebrate and bring visibility to the LGBTQ community, which I think was one of the really big goals of the organizers.
Well, you mentioned there were some speakers that were at this event as well, talking about their experiences being LGBTQ in prison. Can you talk a little bit about what they were saying?
Yeah, so we had a few different speakers. One of them was from, on behalf of True Colors Recovery, Amanda Esquivel-Lopez. So she was tabling, but she shared her experience of being a lesbian woman who was formerly incarcerated and now doing this work, doing recovery services for LGBTQ plus communities who are also formerly incarcerated. And I think that it was a really incredible speech and conversation, just acknowledging the huge barriers that exist for LGBTQ communities inside prison especially, right? And so I think that there were some other speakers as well. Samantha Swan, who is currently incarcerated at OACI, spoke about her experience as a transgender woman and what it's meant to kind of come out and live in her truth. I think it was both celebratory and acknowledgement of the difficulties. And we also heard from Tyler Young, who is one of the main organizers, who unfortunately wasn't able to attend for some health reasons. And they had a wonderful speech that spoke to the origins of Pride and its history of the 1969 Stonewall riots or protest. And I think that that was a really valuable thing to learn. I think for many people, like I mentioned, what Pride looks like today is, I think, in some ways, and for some communities, has strayed very far from its origins. And so I think Tyler's speech did a great job at kind of grounding the intention of what the event is all about. And so, yeah, really great to hear from those folks. You also heard from Galo Van, who is a contributor to Street Roots. He has written columns for us in the past about his experiences as a Native American community member in OSCI and Native issues and things like that. And he really spoke from the perspective of what it means to be kind of an active ally in the prison community to the LGBTQ community, and really these parallels he sees in the struggles of Native American communities, the same for LGBTQ plus communities, and also the intersection that exists there. So really a wide variety of conversations happening, and it really drew a crowd.
In doing this reporting, was there anything that surprised you as you were talking to people?
I think that for anyone who maybe doesn't have a familiarity or relationship with what being in a prison is like, I think that is really unique. I have been to this facility several times before, but I think for maybe readers or listeners who are not familiar, I think really important to recognize the magnitude of this event, the amount of outside visitors that were there, the music that was allowed, and the colorful decorations. You know, that is not something you see on a prison recreation yard. And so I think that is a really important thing to highlight and really special. And one of the folks that I interviewed mentioned that they really appreciated the amount of outside visitors and that there is a really huge humanizing aspect to talk to someone who is not only viewing you as someone who is in prison. And I think that it was just a great and wonderful time to do that. I'm not sure I don't know if I would say I was surprised, but I think that for folks who, you know, don't really truly understand what prison is like, and just the environment and the weight that it carries, I think that that is a huge contrast to the everyday. It was also really wonderful to hear from a wide variety of people who, you know, kind of were like, I came to see what this is all about, or I'm here because, you know, my family member has come out to me and I want to be supportive of my niece or my nephew or what have you. And Christine Shope, the staff member, she really mentioned that she works for the behavioral health services manager. And so she has a chance to talk to a lot of different folks in the prison. And she said she was really surprised at the amount of people she saw, but also certain individuals that she was thinking, you know, I wouldn't expect them to come out and support this event, and seeing people from different walks of life and different faiths and beliefs. So I think that was really a surprise for the organizers, that she also saw this as an opportunity to start with some kind of like base knowledge that, you know, if someone doesn't know what issues LGBTQ plus community are facing, or, you know, understand is like how to ask people about their pronouns or their gender identity. And so she really spoke to the fact that she really sees this as a kind of first step toward bringing folks some knowledge and information that they might not otherwise have. And then for other folks who are, you know, holding this experience of being part of the LGBTQ plus community in prison, are able to see who their allies might be and that their community is there. And that, you know, it doesn't make, you know, all these problems go away and some of the systemic issues that we see in prisons, go away, but there is an opportunity to engage with community and find people who you feel are in your corner.
What do you hope that readers and listeners take away from the story?
That's a great question. I feel really strongly about this story. I think that a few things, one being that pride looks really different for a lot of communities. And I think that the pride that we see in Portland is different from the pride that you see in the Midwest, in the South, a pride celebration that you see in another country in prison, and that, you know, these are really, really valuable celebrations, even if they might look different for some, right? Like a pride in prison, there's no specialty cocktails, there's no parade or any of that, but I think that there's so much value to this celebration and seeing what it looks like for a community of people to come together and want to celebrate their peers or better educate themselves. And I also hope that, yeah, people will see that the LGBTQ community it's huge. And I think that was another thing that one of the folks I interviewed mentioned is just the surprise at realizing, you know, you see the data, but there's a really large LGBTQ community in prisons, and with the higher rates that they're incarcerated, and even more so for transgender people, more so for transgender people of color and those incarceration rates, it's really important to recognize how all of that is working and why these celebrations matter and what it looks like to support people and celebrate pride in very varied ways.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find a copy of your reporting?
You can get a copy of this story in a Street Roots newspaper bought from your local vendor. It's pretty high out, so you might see less vendors around. So if you see that, make sure you support Grab a paper and tip if you can. And you can also read all of our stories at streetreads.org.
Kanani, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Kanani Cortez, the digital producer at Street Roots. We've been talking about her newest article for the paper. It's called Oregon Prison Celebrates Its First Pride Event. A small group organized a historic event to bring visibility to prison's LGBTQIA2S+ communities. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Alfie.
KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
You are listening to KVOO Portland. Become a member of KBOO today by texting KBOO to the phone number 44321. Now stay tuned for